Welcome to Inside Games, the only gaming news show brave enough to write the ending of the episode before we start filming.
It's technically not true this time around. I just have a stack of angry notes about Starfield and Dragon's Dogma 2 to just go on a big unhinged rant, so look forward to that.
I'm really looking forward to that. Breaking news, Lawrence does have opinions about Starfield.
All right, they didn't finish the game, Bruce. They didn't finish it. How do you not have an opinion about that?
All right, I mean, you're right. We can empathize, though, right? We've all had to cram for a last-minute final or a school project or a multi-million dollar video game, right?
Yeah, that's been in development for years and years. Yeah, we've all been there. Apparently, that's what Bethesda did with one of their biggest releases ever.
Yeah, we're talking about Starfield, the much ballyhooed space exploration game that released last year too. I mean, reasonably good success. Okay reviews, reasonably good success.
Yeah, it got a lot of players, that's for sure. But according to a new interview, the game's final quest was just basically thrown together at the last minute.
You don't say. The game's former quest designer, Will Shen, said during a panel at the Game Developers Conference this week that the game's lengthy final quest came together in a frantic fashion.
Starfield was a huge production, he said, which led to collaboration issues and eventually the realization that the game's final event lacked a big set-piece battle, something flashy and explosive. You know, like the Death Star battle at the end of Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean, Starfield definitely needed that. Shen said that he had to hit the panic button when it became clear during development that the game's main quest needed that big final set-piece, according to his comments reported by PC Gamer.
How do you just not know? How do you just not realize? Whatever. They finally settled on a workaround, and we're going to give some mild Starfield spoilers to talk about it, so be forewarned if you haven't finished the game.
The eventual ending of the game involves the planet Masada 3 and a final battle where you bounce around different dimensions to locations you visited earlier in the game.
Shen credited the work of senior level designer Steve Cornett, who had the idea for dimension hopping, which helped save time because the devs didn't have to make a bunch of new locations for the end battle.
And it's sci-fi. I mean, you know, we all do that.
And it feels good to just like revisit all the places you've been at the end of a game.
It always does. Shen talked about Starfield's ending at GDC with former Fallout 76 lead level designer Daryl Brigner in a discussion about the importance of collaboration in level and quest design.
But apparently collaboration can be very difficult when working on a big AAA game for a major studio with huge development teams.
I could see that. Shen said that the size of Starfield's team was part of the issue. It had more than 500 people in total, compared to around 100 for Skyrim and 150 for Fallout 4. That's a huge jump.
Dude, that takes my breath away.
Yeah.
And all those people working for all those years, and I assume most of that work just didn't make it in the game or didn't, I don't know. It's because it doesn't seem like it. Anyway. Shen, this is really interesting because, Bruce, I know we've been here before.
Yeah.
Shen said that big teams like that can cause problems because it creates a silo effect where, quote, every department is scrambling for resources and saying no to collaboration requests.
Man, Lawrence and I have experienced that so often.
I don't know how you break it down. Once that starts happening and teams turn insular and just like fend off everything and try to say no to as much work as possible, sheesh.
Yeah, it's not good for anybody, really. And obviously, if there's little or no collaboration between departments, things can get really bad.
Mm-hmm. Shen said that, quote, every request now has to go through all the producers because we needed to check all of the contingent work.
He added that, quote, asking for something as simple as a chair wasn't so simple. Do you need animations for it? Do you need sound effects for it? How much does that add to the schedule? Can it not fit because one of those teams does not have the time?
That's why you have to plan all that stuff in advance. I'm not like it's easy for me to say that, right? I've never produced a AAA game. But yeah. Logistics are the real enemy, which is really interesting. Ultimately, Starfield's final mission was completed, but in Shen's words, you don't need to wait for an emergency in order to do this. To make game content? Yeah, most people don't, but whatever.
He added that, quote, clear, consistent project level goals and communication will keep everyone focused on what they need to focus on. Boy, is that amazing advice.
Yeah, harder to implement than it is to say because humans are funny creatures. But
yeah.
I mean, on that note, this is hardly the first time we've seen some weird stories about Starfield's development. It sparked a fair amount of controversy when the game launched.
Yeah, the game's design director and lead game writer, Emil Pagliarulo, gave a talk where he seemed to dismiss the importance of design documents in games.
Oh, the ones that say whether or not a chair needs sound effects or anything like that? Who knows? Now, it's a reasonable assumption from there to think that Starfield itself didn't have any design documents, which Pagliarulo later clarified on X that wasn't the case.
I mean, it better. They had 500 people on the team.
How did they even ship the game?
Yeah,
I mean, they had to write something down.
But this story did speak to some discontent with fans who felt like Starfield was kind of a bit overhyped and a little underbaked.
A bit? Just that much? Sure. I mean, yeah, I wasn't a big fan. That's clear. But a lot of people bought it, or played it at least. Bethesda said that Starfield was their biggest launch ever, with more than 6 million players a day after its launch date in September last year.
And Xbox has called it a success, saying in December that it had more than 12 million players. And again, a lot of people were probably just playing it on Game Pass instead of paying full price for it, obviously, which is what you should do.
Yeah, I don't know. Having played the game, I have to admit, I get that I can be a little pinky out sometimes, having played games for 30 years. But what bummed me about Starfield was just its lack of ambition in every regard. It didn't do anything interesting technically. Artistically, there was some stuff there. And there was some writing that was like, okay, that's better than Bethesda's usual stuff. But hearing them describe the silo effect of various departments and how there's no incentive for them to work together to do anything, that kind of it starts to add up why it's just like, maybe the game's not coming along. You throw more teams at it, and the more people you throw in, it's not accelerating, and you don't know why. I mean, I've definitely been in work scenarios before where once there's a perceived restriction of resources, whether that's time or staff or anything, once that gets seen, then everyone closes in. Like, all the wagons circle up, and you need to go to the audio team and ask them for a sound effect, and they go like, I don't know, buddy. You'll have to ask blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just, yeah. People start inventing, what's the word? Bureaucracy. Yeah. People invent these systems of bureaucracy to insulate themselves from having to do work and produce game assets or videos or whatever the case. And once that starts happening, you just need a producer to come in and just like spray everyone with a water bottle. You need a Rod Ferguson to come in and be like, cut that shit out. We're making a game and we're going to ship it. It makes more sense now that I'm getting further away from it and developers are telling more story about it.
Yeah, Lawrence and I have only really worked on, like, we haven't worked on teams of 500. We worked on teams of, I mean, you know, 100 people, maybe 150 people at most at an organization. And even then people silo off, and we're just talking teams of like 7 people or five people. And then they start really making it so that no one can get any work done. And that really is, in my opinion, that's the enemy of creativity with, you know, the commercial success on the back of it. Is if you're producing for people to buy it, you got to get something done. That's actually why I respect Rod Ferguson, because he does that. He goes in and he goes, we got to get it done. So let's ship the game, you know, like, and it may not be perfect, but at least it is a video game that I think a lot of people enjoy. Rod Ferguson is good at that. He's one of the few fixers in the industry that we know about. I'm sure there's a ton more.
Yeah, the Hatchet Man. I love it. It's interesting to watch he shipped Bioshock Infinite back in the day, which is where I was like, ooh, this guy. Bioshock Infinite was not done, mm-hmm. but at least it was released and people could buy it and play it. So yeah, it's it's fun to start tracking the production of games and get a little more insight into the logistics of games production, especially as they're ballooning in scale. A lot of game developers are struggling now to kind of like square the scale of games with the product that gets released. And a lot of the times you throw more people at a project, you know, you get a mega game like Spider-Man 2, but it doesn't sell 10 times as much, even though it had 10 times the staff.
All right, Lawrence, you and I have been reading a lot of the comments on Inside Games. We've got a lot of new people that have come over, by the way. Thank you very much for watching. And hello. All of our opinions are absolutely not at all new. We've been repeating these opinions for years and years and years. But you may be new to hearing us express our opinions. And so it's good to see people having actual, you know, debates in the chat or in the comments. We appreciate that very, very much. I know Lawrence has written a bunch of stuff about... because Lawrence and I will rant to each other on Discord all the time about these comments. So I'm excited to hear Lawrence's rant, but I'll happily jump in at any point because Lawrence and I generally agree on most things.
Yeah, I think we do. Let me think of how to start this. Mostly it's like people accusing us of being out of touch. And honestly, like, I don't disagree based on where people are coming from when they say that. But I take issue with...
Of course, yeah.
There's a troublesome trend growing in games media that we started this channel explicitly to contradict.
Mm.
And that's this cycle of spinning up false drama and then people in the media leaning into it because that's what the audience wants them to do. I have no intention of being sycophantic with my media. With whatever I say on this show, This is my honest appraisal of what's going on, and it may not agree with consensus at the time, especially if that consensus is born out of a bunch of fake info, which is essentially what happened with Dragon's Dogma. But, all right, so let me get some disclaimers about Dragon's Dogma out of the way first, and then I'm going to draw some comparisons to Starfield to kind of illustrate why Dragon's Dogma is not the thing you should be mad at right now. And most people aren't. I've actually seen a lot of Reddit posts being like, hey, the DLC thing was totally made up. So, yes, it was, but...
Yeah.
All right, disclaimers. Buying items in games is stupid. It doesn't make sense, and it's dumb. It'll always be dumb.
Always has
the idea been. That you can pay $1 for a game power fucking sucks. I mean, arcade games did this way back in the day, right? They would kill you and then say continue. I mean, that's where this is theoretically coming from, and I think speaks to a lot of gamers' paranoia, is that Dragon's Dogma 2 was forcing you into purchases by restricting game features. And on that note, having one save slot is also really dumb. I didn't like that.
So stupid. Lawrence, it's so stupid. I could go off on, by the way, on the fast travel of Dragon's Dogma, I could go off for hours about how bad it is.
Oh man, I love it.
I can't stand it. I can't stand the system in Dragon's Dogma 2 of the walking around and losing your stamina and doing all that. I really can't stand it. However, I think the game itself is really great, and I love it. But go right ahead.
Man, I think it's 10 million times better than Starfield's, like, load you directly in front of the NPC you need to talk to.
Oh, compared to Starfield? Oh my gosh, you're right, yes. Absolutely, you're correct. It's way better than Starfield.
I mean, there is a happy middle ground there, for sure. But let's get into the comparisons, which... another disclaimer. When I'm talking about you, or complaining about things, I'm not talking about you, the viewer. I'm talking about games culture or enthusiast games culture. And that's important because when people were shitting on Dragon's Dogma 2, they were saying, no, we're like kicking up a bunch of dust so they don't do this in the future. That doesn't make any sense either because games culture doesn't move uniformly. They move very impulsively and emotionally. And all it does is train developers to just manage you like an angry pet as opposed to actually listening to what you have to say. So let me point this out here. All right. People had problems with Dragon's Dogma's 2's DLC and performance, right? If we were looking for consistency, I think comparing it to how people received Starfield shows that there's zero consistency there. Starfield was locked 30 on consoles, and also it only launched on 2 consoles. And it didn't do anything interesting or new. It just generated a blank landscape for you to run around in and scan animals on. Dragon's Dogma 2 drops to 30 only in the cities and does a ton of new technical stuff. No load screens anywhere. It's got a curated open world, which is what everyone said they wanted out of Starfield. It's got interesting interactions with NPCs, I think. And then there's always 3 pawns running after you, pointing out every fucking ladder they see. So it's doing more. It's fundamentally simulating more, but somehow Dragon's Dogma dropping to 30s in cities is unacceptable. Also, we have a longer tail view of it. We remember what Skyrim ran like. We remember what GTA 5 ran like.
It was terrible.
Yeah, it was. We're dealing with a 3-year-old console in an open world game. 30 FPS under load isn't that bad. Now, granted, it can drop to 25 or even 20 when you're really bogging it down. But still, come on. People were okay with this in the past. It's anything but an unplayable technical mess. It's just like the internet pushing things to extremes. Also, on the note of DLC, because this bugged me forever, and everyone didn't have a problem with it. Starfield sold you $20 of DLC that didn't even have a logo, didn't even have a title graphic, no descriptions
Shattered
of
Space, right?
Anything. Yeah, Shattered Space? What the hell is that? We still don't know!
Nobody knows. Yeah, nobody knows.
Bethesda had the gall to ask money for DLC that they didn't tell you a thing about, and also charge you for early access on top of Game Pass. That's insulting to me. And people did it with a smile on their face. They're like, oh, Bethesda's going to deliver. We trust Bethesda. You shouldn't. But here's Dragon's Dogma selling $1 DLC for a thing you can get in game for like, yeah, it's dumb. It's dumb, but it's honest, at least.
But also, correct me if I'm wrong, Lawrence, there's a maximum amount of transactions you can make. So once you've bought it, I think at the maximum 5 times, that's it. You can't buy it anymore.
Yeah, most of them you can only buy once.
Yeah.
And the other ones are gated. So... even if they design the game to squeeze you dry, they still put a cap on the amount of squeezing they're going to do, and they told you what the cap was. So they're telling you everything up front and enabling you to make the decision, and somehow that's more insulting. Now, Grant, again, I'm drawing a lot of false equivalences here, but I'm just talking about games culture in general and the way people move and the things they choose to attack. So here's the problem, is there's a bunch of, like, honestly, it's just a bunch of dunking with the most flimsy justification so everyone feels empowered to do it. you know what? That's tabloid culture. You're not going to change you're not going to change the human experience so much that goes away. What's especially bothersome to me, and I think the reason that I was motivated to start doing this, is that games media is starting to do it too. They're getting especially sycophantic with the audience. It's definitely a trend. I think Cyberpunk gave everyone a taste of blood, of how good it feels to shit on other people's work and do so valiantly. So now it feels like games culture just wants a holy war every month or so, mm-hmm. and they just pick an easy target that they can manufacture a narrative about. I brought this up before, this is kind of good for business. It drives a lot of views to YouTube, drives views to Twitch, but it comes at the expense of the games themselves and everyone who worked on them. We can all rise together. We don't have to feed off of the honest work of people who tried hard to make something good. And that's what I see in Dragon's Dogma 2. It's a genuine, earnest work with a lot of cool video game shit in it. And yet, somehow, people are distracting themselves, complaining about something that's not even real.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, that's what I use this channel to speak out against. In the hopes that somebody who would like the game can cut through the BS and be like, oh, this game's fun and I'm glad I played it.
Yeah, Lawrence and I are probably at some point going to do either a podcast or an episode in the future, in the near future, about microtransactions. Because I saw a lot of people say, you know what, Lawrence, we have never been okay with microtransactions. You shouldn't be okay with microtransactions ever. All right. I saw that comment so much that I was like, you got it. So what we're going to do is we're going to produce an episode or a podcast about microtransactions. And you should, if you feel that way, if I see those comments on this episode, then you should never buy a microtransaction ever in any video game. I don't want to see any Overwatch skins. I don't want to see any War Bonds and Helldivers. I don't want to see none of that because those are all microtransactions. So it's very important that if you take a stand, because I believe in your stand. I do. I believe in it. But you got to be consistent. You can't say this one game has microtransactions, I hate it, while the other one, you turn around and spend a bunch of money on it. You can't. Because the industry as a whole sees what you're doing in Helldivers or in Overwatch, and they take it and they run with it. So you just got to be careful. And I really do admire your conviction, but you have to be consistent with your conviction. And that's very hard to do. But I do think that we will produce a podcast about that so that we can, I mean, honestly, help you with that conviction. Really, truly, I'm happy to do it. Because me personally, I just pick and choose the things I spend my money on. So I'm not like, oh, I hate all microtrends. I don't care. If Capcom charges me $1 for a fairy stone, I just say, no, I'm not going to spend that $1. It's very, very easy for me. But I see a lot of people fighting every microtransaction tooth and nail, and I appreciate it. So we're going to say, don't ever spend your money on microtransactions. Ever.
I guess. Or spend equal amounts of time you spend shitting on DLC to celebrate the games that don't have it, which is another thing I don't see, which I think speaks to the actual motivations of the people who are saying these things. Doom Eternal, AAA game, no DLC, nothing. And they updated it with patches and stuff. Now I'm a Doom fanboy, but still, I didn't see a whole lot of people being like, they did it right, and we need to support this, and we should celebrate this. I mean, it came out. Most people were just like, this game is too much, which I also get. But also, hey, they tried to do it right. Where was their parade? Everyone tells them, you can't just shit on the bad if that's your actual motivation. You need to uplift the good.
That's right. All right. We also have an Inside Games Patreon. Now, you may or may not be supporting it, but I do know these people are supporting it, and they never forget the endings to their games like Bethesda did for Starfield. Red End 003, Shaky Pants, and Brandon Young.
Well, I got some patrons on the other end of the scale, Bruce. They've never finished a game, so why bother even making an ending? Who cares? I mean, that's... Jeez, the NES games that just didn't have an ending? Anyway. Matt Bogenberger, UASC Battleroid, and Jambers87, thank you very much.